Welcome back to Redefining AI, the show that uncovers the nuances of artificial intelligence, exploring its impact and evolution across industries. I'm your host, Lauren Hawker-Zaffer, and today I'm exploring a very topical field that has seen a rise in popularity in many sectors, namely the topic of digital humans. Now, what is the state of digital humans and how is it actually perceived at the moment? Is it creepy? Or is it cool? Now, to do this, I've been joined by Renny Schulte. So welcome, Renny. Welcome to Redefining AI.
Thanks for having me, Lauren. I'm looking forward to fun conversations. And I can tell you, digital humans are definitely needed.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to explore as well. Are they needed or are they not needed? Let's see. So maybe tell us a little bit about yourself. Why have we been joined by you today? What is it that you bring to the table? And how can you help us explore this interesting topic, Renny?
Absolutely. So like you said, my name is René. I work for Reply, which is a consulting and system integrator with 15,000 employees worldwide. And my function there is I work for our CTO and manage so-called communities of practices. These are basically R&D teams that work on innovative topics. And I look after those that are synthetic data, quantum computing, digital humans, which brings us to the topic of today, spatial computing, and general AI. So all the fun emerging technologies, and digital human actually incorporates a lot of these things together. And so I do a lot of basically not only innovation management, but I also try to still get my hands a little bit dirty with some of the stuff. And, you know, my background is I'm a developer originally. I haven't written much code in a while, which is, well, you know, the course of the career sometimes. But what I'm also doing, I'm also a Microsoft MVP for mixed reality as well as quantum computing and a Microsoft regional director, which are awards that Microsoft provides to independent experts that share their knowledge. So I'm very active in social media. So if you want to connect on LinkedIn, you constantly see some new stuff being shared. And also, I do a lot of conference talks, keynotes, and so on. And, you know, that's being honored by Microsoft for certain experts. So that's not like the MVP program and regional director program. You don't get paid. It's basically rewards for independent experts, right? So quite active in the field and always passionate about technology, and especially AI and 3D, real-time 3D. And with digital humans, we bring all of this together.
Wow, sounds fascinating. You're certainly well-versed. I can see you've been immersed yourself and engaged in a lot of different aspects of technology. So you mentioned quite a few of them there. Obviously, we've got synthetic data, we've got quantum computing, we've got spatial computing, which I think is virtual reality, augmented reality, the extensive reality. I mean, what do they cover? Because it's quite a lot of terms at the start as well. I think that people might be sort of in touch with maybe quantum computing, but they might not be so familiar with, you know, synthetic data, spatial computing, et cetera. Can you give us a slight introduction into the technologies that you've touched upon?
Yeah, surely. So quantum computing, I guess, like most people know, that's all about, like, you know, getting new forms of computers established, but also new forms of algorithms. Because you cannot just write your classic algorithms and run them on a quantum computer, that doesn't work. And so for companies like us, the focus is on the software side, like quantum algorithms, right? Synthetic data is also a super interesting field. Basically, it's all about how can I leverage, for example, these novel photorealistic 3D rendering to create virtual scenes, which I can then use to actually train an AI model. But for certain scenarios, it's very hard to get real-world data. Think about, you want to train a robot that will rescue people in a mine when there's a fire. Well, try to simulate that in the real world, right? That's, of course, quite impossible almost. So what you would do is you would basically create a 3D scenery, but replicate that. And now with the you know, I think we're going to talk about some of 3D rendering and some photorealistic quality. But now we have this like ray tracing and other technologies, which allow us to get very photorealistic quality that is almost indistinguishable from the real world. And so we can simulate a lot of scenarios and then create training data, right? And spatial computing is an interesting term, which you also now hear from Apple Vision. Apple Vision Pro is also called spatial computing device. I have been using this term since, I don't know, more than 5 years or something. And I'm really happy that it's picked up a little bit broader in the industry. But yeah, it's about devices that can spatially sense your environment. So it could be like a headset you put on, but it could also be a mobile phone. It could be also a car in the end. You know, devices that spatially sense your surrounding. And oftentimes this is combined also with virtual or augmented reality to augment what you're seeing in the end, right? But the big breakthrough, especially when we talk about digital human, it comes really from the advance of generative AI, right? Okay. This is a huge contributor to this technology, because a digital human is two pieces, basically. A digital human is, first of all, the visual aspect, where, like I said, we have now, since a few years maybe, very photorealistic rendering quality. So we can have very, you know, human lifelike looking 3D models, basically. And the other component for digital human is the brain, right? And this is oftentimes customized large language model or whatever kind of AI system. So you can have a meaningful conversation. Mm. And so, you know, this technology brings a lot of pieces together.
Yeah, that would have been my question. It's more about, from my perspective, obviously you've worked as well with a lot of teams on the development and the involvement of bringing all of these aspects together to create a digital human. So in working with these teams to collaborate to create a sort of cohesive and advanced digital human experience, where do you place focus and what's your sort of process in that to create an ideal or sort of good digital human experience?
Yes. So you got to focus, of course, on the visual aspect. It needs to look, you know, realistic. And it needs to also have a little bit of a connection to the user in terms of, you know, I think we're going to touch also a little bit on this later on about the cultural aspect, right? It needs to have a connection. It also needs to have a personality in the end. And so a lot of things come together, and especially the parts of generative AI is important. So we have, when we build these digital humans, like the teams are, you know, come have different roles, obviously, but they also come from different fields in the end. So we have like 3D experts, like 3D artists, 3D animators, like character animation is a specific field, right? And so we bring these together, plus the data scientists, the AI experts, for working on the brain of the digital human. And the key aspect is really to have a customized brain and to have a customized large language model. In the end, what you do there is technologies like REG, retrieval augmented generation, where you're taking, you know, custom data and basically you know, turn this in such a format that you can use it with a large language model and then can have a meaningful conversation with a digital human.
Yeah. A few interesting concepts that you've mentioned there as well, obviously, to create that sort of perfect digital human experience. Now, if we're looking at the customization in particular of the brain, how easy is it? And is this again reliant upon the accessibility to synthetic data, or where do you get the data sets to actually create this customized brain? Yeah. You've mentioned as well retrieval augmented generation, which is a term that's used very heavily in the industry at the moment, which helps retrieve a lot of information. But is this a component that helps you create the perfect sort of customized brain? Maybe you can lead us down that path a little.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's a common, like you said, that's a common way these days to basically get your own business data, your own data into a large language model in the end. And so that's what we're using a lot. Sometimes also fine-tuning. Sometimes we also might not even use like a very large language model, like a GPT-4 or something, but you can also use smaller models, which you can even run locally, right? And a lot of those are open source. Or open weights, rather, right? Like Llama from Meta or Phi-2 from Microsoft, a 3 billion parameter model, which I can even run on my laptop very fast. And so you can quickly also fine-tune these models and even retrain it if you want. But mostly what we're doing is retrieval augmented generation. And what we have, for example, when we're talking about a virtual sales assistant, we have one, for example, for virtual car sales. And this was basically using GPT APIs, but we created embeddings with custom data for that specific car, right? So we have the product sheet of that car, and then we can turn this into embeddings and inject it into the large language model. And that works really well. And you get very good grounding on your knowledge base. And so that's what we do mostly, right? Is like basically taking a custom data. And the most of the time when you're dealing with LLMs and REC is actually data massaging, right? It's like getting the data into the right formats so that you actually in the end have it as embeddings. And that's where you actually will spend most of the time for many Gen AI projects these days.
Everything that you've said leads me back to one question and the emphasis of the emergence of generative AI. Do you think that there's been an interest? And again, it relates to the capabilities of the technologies as well. But do you think that digital humans have become far popular because of the access to, as you've mentioned, smaller foundational models, the open source encouragement of being able to use different models in a sort of a comfortable way? Or is it something else? Like, why are digital humans now more popular than they were before?
Yeah, definitely it's the advancements we see with Gen AI and, you know, the ease of creating a custom knowledge bases in the end. I mean, I kind of hate to say that word with knowledge base, because large language models are not really knowledge bases. They are pattern spotting engines that, you know, basically find the next best token, next best word in a sequence.
Exactly.
So they're not like factual search engine, as we all know. But the thing is, you can ground it, and if you fine tune it, but also use REC with good grounding, you can make pretty much sure that most of the requests, or 99%, are really in the context of what you ask it for. And yes, definitely the availability also of smaller foundational models is a huge milestone. If you look at what happened since Meta released Llama and all the progress in the research field and the industry based on Llama and the models that are coming out every day, it's incredible. And that is, I mean, I'm a fan also of GPT, OpenAI, Google Gemini, you name it, like Amazon, all of them, they have their big foundational models are working on it. It's all great, but I'm definitely a big fan of the open weight models because they are open and they are small, usually much smaller, and you can run them either on a laptop sometimes. Like I said, I can run one of the small models directly on my GPU, and it's not a huge laptop. And I can, you know, have an LLM on an airplane, basically, and, you know, rewrite some text and stuff. It works really, really well. That's fantastic. But also, you're not constrained by the REC teaming and the censoring, if you will, that, you know, these large language models are doing. I mean, surely I'm fully on the side that we need certain regulation, and it can be dangerous if an LLM just answers everything for you, right? There's some really bad stuff there, what it can do. But on the other hand, sometimes if you're using GPT-4 or Gemini Ultra, they're way too restrictive. Even if you ask like simple things, sometimes they just say, no, I cannot answer that, right? And that can be a challenge. And that if we're thinking about like the philosophical or even political aspect of it, it's even broader, right? Like the values of OpenAI or the values of Google when they do the restrictions in these models might not align with my values, right? And so the whole alignment of AI is probably the biggest challenge we're going to face in the next couple of years. But it's an interesting challenge. But that's why I like these open models, right? You can put your own constraints on top of it. You still want to have that, obviously, because you want to prevent certain things. That's why I like these open models, but mostly really because it's pushing the research way forward.
Yeah, it's pushing the research way forward. And I also think going back to the component that you mentioned around being able to run it on your own laptop, it is far more accessible if it is something that you can use and run yourself, if there's not that extensive need for a large amount of computational power, which would then bring me on to, you know, it's a great idea to bring knowledge into a digital human. And you mentioned the example of like a virtual sales configurator, and that in itself is very intriguing. Can you maybe share some more examples of how businesses are actually effectively using digital humans in real world scenarios?
Absolutely. So I already touched a little bit on the virtual car sales assistant. So we worked with an automotive manufacturer together to create this virtual car sales assistant. So basically, you can imagine it like this. There's a new car that you can buy, and you get a car configurator. If you ever, got a new car, you probably have seen those. You can do this online for most car manufacturers these days, where you configure your car. But there are so many different variations, right? The permutations for certain cars goes into millions, right? All the different combinations. And so you need a good device. And so that's also what you can do with a digital human. So what you have in this application that we developed is basically a digital human, a 3D character, and it's in next to a car. And it's also super photorealistic quality with ray tracing, like beautiful, you know, rendering. It looks very lifelike. And so then you can talk with that person, with the digital human, and very nice visualization. But she also has this, her name is Lisa, and she also has the brain, the large language model, which is with REC, you know, basically customized for this specific car. And she can answer all the questions about the car, but you can also customize it. So when there's a request being done by the user, just by speaking or typing the prompt, whatever, both modalities are supported, then this is also analyzed. If the input the user has given is not just a question, but also maybe it has to trigger an action, right? So for example, I want to have this car in blue, I want to have it in yellow, whatever. So it makes all these changes. You can see the rims and so on. So you can configure it and learn more about it. That's one scenario. And another sales scenario where we recently launched is for a cruise ship company. You have basically a kiosk on deck of the cruise ship. And if you want to book an excursion, like a day trip, right? When the ship is in the port, you can now do this also with a digital human. So he can talk with this digital human. She has all the knowledge about all the different excursions, and you get a very also, realistic and very a human and natural dialogue, basically, right? Instead of just looking for a brochure, you can actually have a conversation about it. And also a great project we did beside the sales assistants, you can also do brand ambassadors, right? You can create digital humans as your brand ambassador. And what we also recently did is we brought back an historic person. We brought back Luigi Einaudi. He was the second president. He was the second president of Italy. So it's not Ludovico Einaudi, which is a famous composer, great piano music, and so on. It's Luigi Einaudi. I don't know if they're related, but Luigi Einaudi was the second president of Italy and also an economics expert. And we worked together with the Luigi Einaudi Foundation to bring him back to life, if you will. And now you can go to Luigi Einaudi Foundation on the website and have a conversation with him about, you know, economics, because we basically customized his brain, if you will, with all his papers, his books about economics. So like that's a really, really cool thing. And it's very easily accessible because you can do it on the website while still providing a good visual quality thanks to pixel streaming, which is a technology where you remotely render your scene. But anyhow, these are some details, but maybe these three examples are good.
Yeah, they're very representative of the possibilities that could be explored by the implementation of digital humans. And there's so many single threads that can be followed from all three of those examples. So let me pick out a couple of threads that I think will be of interest and also good exploration and also pertains to the topic of the conversation. This sort of, is it creepy or is it cool? Because obviously, if we take the example of maybe, you know, Lisa, so we have a female, a digital human that has been created using custom data. Lisa, very generic, there's no connotation or indication of where she comes from. Should there be an indication or connotation? I mean, there's obviously the components of, you know, cultural nuances that influence the design, the reception of digital personas when you're actually integrating it into a working environment. How do you take those into consideration, and where is that reflected in the design per se?
Yeah,
and is there more of like what I've always questioned, and I asked you this before, you know, is there more of a like geographical preference and popularity for digital humans?
Absolutely. A great question, by the way. And there is for sure. So if we're saying, I mean, these questions are, I think, twofold. Like, first of all, like, you know, where is it popular? And also, how can you kind of align for this culture in the end? So definitely, if you're looking at countries like South Korea or Asia in general, I mean, they're always in front when it comes to innovation and always, you know, open to new things. If you look at, you know, I'm from Germany, right? So if you look here in Germany, they're always a little bit resistant, right, to some of that stuff. So you first of all have these kind of two sides of the coin, if you will. But yeah, just look at some of, especially South Korea, if you look at some of the influencers there, right? They have like digital human influencers, right? Or you see a lot of avatars in a lot of games, and even like whole K-pop bands as avatars. And so that has been in the culture since quite a while. And I think that's an important aspect, like people connect easier to this, right? So that's cool. But how can you actually design your solution to get closer to the cultural meaning? And that's a very important aspect. And so for example, what we did with a banking customer when we created basically a different digital humans for them, what we did is we did a cultural, I would say, customizations. And so, for example, for the Egyptian market, they wanted to have this digital human. We have chosen a male that is speaking Arabic. And for like another European market, we have chosen a female that is, you know, speaking in that native language. And that's also an important aspect, that you can also, you know, use the native language and, you know, the kind of native tongue. And so that also the voice synthesis is also very believable, right? And then you have technologies like neural voices these days, where you can create very good sounding artificial voices. So they sound like a human. You don't really hear that it's a robot. I mean, experts might still hear it, but you can generate very good. And of course, you need to attach this also potentially even with a dialect, right? With a local dialect, if you want to get a level further down from the country level, maybe to the states or, you know, the counties or so. And that's important that you basically customize it and make it relevant and also use other cultural differences, right? Like certain, like if the digital human, for example, uses also hands to show certain things, right? You might want to avoid certain signs and certain gestures in certain cultures, right? That kind of stuff. So yeah, very important.
Yeah, very important. I mean, it has to resonate with the audience and they have to be able to accept it on a cultural, a personal and emotional level. There's one important topic which goes more to the more skeptical side of implementation of technologies like this, because you've always got the rise of bad actors in technology. How do you see, Rene, the industry per se addressing issues like this? I mean, obviously you've got the example that you gave in the presidential implementation, you know, creating the digital human there. There's a lot of people that might say, you know, well, there's a lot of issues related to the consent, ensuring that there's responsible use, especially if there's a sensitive nature. I mean, I recently saw that one company was using, you know, saved audio of people that had recently passed away. I mean, there is, you know, these sensitive issues, especially when it comes to using someone else's voice or likeness to create digital humans that can evoke a lot of maybe undesired emotions in certain individuals. What's your opinion there? How do you see the industry addressing these issues?
Yeah. It's definitely a very good thought, and it's important to stick to the rules, if you will. And there's, for example, one rule that most of the big vendors, the big cloud vendors that provide null voice systems stick to is, for example, you cannot recreate a voice clone of a person that is diseased if they have not given the consent before they passed away, right? And so, for example, with Luigi Einaudi, like, we could have basically cloned his voice. I mean, the technology is out there. You also have lots of, you know, smaller startups that provide these voice cloning services where they don't care about the ethical aspect, right? And that's what you see a lot being used maybe online and on social media, right? Where they fake celebrity voices and do some memes or fun videos. It's all fun until, you know, you abuse this technology. And that is also being done for sure, like with null voice cloning, where people are basically, you know, cloning a voice of a person in a company, and then they're tricking another person to believe it's maybe their boss on the other line, and then they make a wire transfer. This has happened multiple times, right? It's out there. And so it's important that you know, professionals like us stick to the rules. And for example, we did not recreate Luigi Einaudi's voice, although we could have done. There's enough audio material, but it's just unethical to do because we didn't have his consent, right? Although we are working with his foundation, it's still a person, right? And so if they couldn't have gotten their consent, like, that's not what you're going to do. And what you see at all these big companies and also research institutions, they have all these AI, responsible AI or ethical AI committees, AI security committees that ensure safe and responsible usage. And also at Reply, we have an AI ethical committee, right, that makes sure that, you know, the projects are aligned with human values and don't create harm, right?
Yeah. Which sounds like a very wise decision. It's been a fascinating conversation. You've taken us the start in an evolving tour of the technologies. We've learned about synthetic data, quantum computing, spatial computing. We've discovered where it would be of benefit to actually integrate a digital human into our working environments. And we've also touched upon the very sort of pressing, invisible concerns about the positive and negative uses of digital humans. So I'll leave you, the audience, to decide if you think it's cool or if you think it's creepy. Thank you, Rene, for this conversation on redefining AI today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for everyone who's listened to the conversation today. If you've enjoyed the episode, then share it. Thank you.